Well, as I was preparing this message, I was reminded of a not-so-old comedy routine. And you may or may not have heard of it. You may or may not have heard of this character. But if you ever saw Blue Collar TV, you might have. And if you didn't, you probably really didn't miss anything. But I liked the sound of it because it fits this particular occasion. The comedian is Bill Engvall, and he has a routine called Here's Your Sign. And it basically has this proposition. If stupid people just wore a sign, you could avoid unnecessary and unpleasant contact with them. If they just had a sign that said, I'm stupid, then you could just leave them alone. You wouldn't ask them anything. And that's an interesting thought, although I don't think it's going to happen. So we're still stuck with where we always have been. And he thought of this apparently on some occasions when he had encounters with people who said things in spite of the situation being entirely obvious. For instance, he recalls, he's from Texas, and he recalls having driven to a service station with a flat tire. And the service attendant came out and said, got a flat tire? And he said, no, actually, I was driving, and the rest of them just swelled up. And he said, the guy, without missing a beat, he said, the heat'll do that. And then he wanted to say, here's your sign. And he continues with other things because that's part of his routine. But it caused me to think about this because the situation here, there's a particular person who probably needed to have a sign that said something comparable. So with that in view, we're going to be looking at Isaiah chapter 7. And there is a verse in Isaiah chapter 7 which stands out because it's one that's quoted in the New Testament. It's one that we all know. It's one that we recognize around Christmas time in particular. But we may not always think so much about the context of what the other verses are around it and what that has to do with that verse. And so we want to think about that today. So we want to start by thinking about the historical context that's here. And ultimately what we'll see as we look at the mention of the signs. So we want to think about what was it that brought up this reference to a sign that's coming up in Isaiah chapter 7. Because what we'll see is this whole situation that's taking place here has to do with a problem of trust. And so that's the issue. And the sign, is it for stupid people or not? Because it's mentioned, because it says the Lord himself will show you a sign. What was that all about? What was it for? And what does it mean? And so we need to see the context. And so we'll have to spend some time on the context before and on the context after and think about what is involved in this passage. So we see the reluctance to properly trust. That is the problem that is identified in this passage. And so we need to think about that. And we should be thinking about, well, am I ever in that same kind of situation where I don't properly trust God? Have I ever been there? You don't have to think too long and hard about that, probably. So we need to think about the text here, Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1 and 2 to start with. It says, now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. So the first thing we need to think about here is we have two kings, king of Syria, Rezin, and king of Israel, Pekah, who's often referenced as just the son of Remaliah, not giving him as much credit as what he thinks he deserves. But this is in the days of Ahaz, and it's going to be about Ahaz. And the thing that's maybe unusual here is that you have the related people, Israel, and joining up with Syria, going against Judah. And you know, you can see that's not a good situation. And this is the first historical element that's referenced, other than chapter 6, where it says, in the year that King Uzziah died. And this is the grandson of King Uzziah that's referenced here. And so then it continues, and it was told to the house of David, that means Judah, to the king and those people, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. So Syria and Ephraim is a term that's often used for Israel, because Ephraim was one of the central tribes there, and a significant one, in the vicinity of Samaria, the capital. So his heart, whose heart? That's Ahaz. And the people, and the heart of his people, that is the people of Judah, were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with the wind. That means they were shaken. They were nervous. They were concerned. So that's the picture that we need to be thinking about here. So they were facing a real and present danger. It was real, and it was close by, and it was coming down on them. So it was a real threat. A united front provided a military threat to Judah. They were intending on causing trouble. And so this created, as you might imagine, concern on the part of Ahaz, and it was going to indicate trust issues. Who is he trusting? Would Ahaz trust God? Or would he resort to his own works? Would he trust in God or in soldiers and in armies? And you can kind of see where this is going. So some background information is helpful here. We need to expand just a little bit on this. We need to think about who instigated the situation of Syria and Israel coming against Judah. Who would have come up with the idea? Was it Syria? Was it Israel? Or somebody else? So we have to look at 2 Kings 15:37. In those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Now, why would the Lord do that? Doesn't he know that Israel and Judah are supposed to be like brothers? I mean, they're like really closely related. They're supposed to be friends and all of that. So that's telling us who initiated this. And, you know, we have come to expect this because there are various peoples and nations that need a judgment because of disobedience from time to time, and this is part of that process. Then we need to think about, well, what do we know about Ahaz? And so for this, we need to look at 2 Kings 16, 1-5, where we read, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. So that's giving us some context. 17th year of Pekah, so Pekah had been around for a little while. And then Ahaz is now the king of Judah, and he begins to reign, and he was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. So that's a basic statement of evaluation that the prophet who is writing Kings is indicating. He was not a follower of the Lord. He did not obey consistently. And so he's evaluated right there. But then it continues, verses 3 and 4, and it goes into some more detail. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. What do we know about the kings of Israel? They were all bad. Kings of Judah, some of them were better than others. Indeed, he made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel, and he sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. So he was into paganism, and he was likely involved in what we would call syncretism. He was taking some of this and mixing it with his own belief, and so it was becoming somewhat of a mixture of things, and he was adding to orthodox belief things that were not orthodox at all, but pagan. And then verse 5 says, then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. So that says the same thing that Isaiah is indicating. So this was a political situation that had come to pass because the Lord had inaugurated it, had initiated it, brought it to pass. Now, did Rezin and did Pekah know that the Lord had initiated it? No, they thought they were doing it. They thought they came up with the idea. And so God is using their desires and their interests to orchestrate this whole event in order to bring about his purpose. 2 Chronicles 28:5 indicates another occasion of attack where Syria attacks and kills a number of people and takes captives. And so we have what appears to be one event that took place about 736 and another event that took place about 734 B.C. So there was more than one attack that was taking place. And the passage seems to indicate that these events are taking place because of Ahaz's behavior, because of his wrong behavior and his disobedience and his going astray from where the Lord wanted him to go. So we need to have that in mind to know who we're dealing with here. So this serious threat caused great disheartening in Judah, and rightly so, because we see there's an attack and there's a very real and present danger of maybe something very bad happening to Ahaz and to Judah. So this puts fear in the heart of Ahaz and in all of Judah. And so what should they do? If you have somebody attacking you, what are your options? Well, you can run and hide, or you can try to fight back, or are there any other options? Could you pray to the Lord? Could you say, Lord, help us? Well, that's a thought that apparently didn't come to Ahaz's mind. So what did Ahaz do? 2 Kings 16, 7 and 8 gives us some more detail that Isaiah assumes, but doesn't really go into detail, because he assumes, well, you've read the book, you already know. So now, if you haven't read the book, now you need to, so that you do know. So it tells us, so Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, that's beyond Syria, toward the Fertile Crescent near the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in that area, in the northern part there. And so he sends to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. What do we know about Assyria? Really nice people, right? Really nice people. No, not at all. So why would you want them to be the people that help you? So he says, I am your servant and your son. That's talking, that's using language of a suzerainty treaty kind of thing. He's saying, I need somebody to help me. You are a superpower. I am not a superpower. I need to align myself with a superpower to help me against this threat of this alliance that's going on. So he says, come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rise up against me. You hear what he said there? He said, save me. He said to Assyria, save me. Seriously? And to make matters worse, Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and then the treasuries of the king's house and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So he was trying to buy some help. And he is pillaging the temple. Well, he wasn't using the temple anyway because he was too busy with worshiping under every green tree and all the other pagan elements. So he was already down that path. Then verses 9 and 10. So the king of Assyria heeded him. For the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried its people captive to Kir and killed Rezin. Time frame, we're not told exactly how much time it elapsed in there, but that's the end result. Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. This is in Damascus, which is in Syria, north of Israel, and a little bit east. And saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the design of the altar and its pattern according to all its workmanship. So what did he do? He's going to this foreign nation. And don't you wonder who this foreign nation worships? Not Yahweh. So he sees an altar and he said, that's a really neat altar. I gotta have one of those. Let's get this design and take it back to Jerusalem and let's make an altar just like this pagan altar in Damascus. So, what do we see? Well, we see someone who has responded exactly opposite of what he should have done. He did it exactly wrong. He was fearful, and he, instead of going to the Lord and saying, Lord, help me, I mean, he had the priest who could have interceded for him, but he missed that opportunity. So he went to the most cruel and pagan foreign power of the day. One commentator said, it was like a mouse asking help from a cat against two rats. That pretty well sums it up. That's pretty clear. And so he then focuses in on this altar that he wants to duplicate. Further evidence of syncretism, taking some of their stuff and bringing it to our worship place. And he's thinking, this is an upgrade. You know, this is altar 3.61. This is really better than what God told us to make. So, you know, it's a good thing. I'm upgrading things here. Well, as I think about this, to make it a little more practical for what we're dealing with today, we don't have so much of copying altars of pagan gods per se, but we do other things. And one of the other things that is happening is another form of syncretism that's going on in our world today, especially in the realm of devotional literature. There's been a lot of this. It's an embracing of elements of New Age thought and elements of mysticism that are creeping into the evangelical church. The whole area of spiritual formation, that movement, is part of that kind of thinking. And it's bringing in stuff that is diluting and leading astray and focusing our attention away from God and His Word into a mysticism kind of thing. And then instead of our trust being in the Lord, our trust is then in the system, in this kind of thinking. And so we need to be aware of that and guard against kind of the junk that is in a lot of the devotional literature that's out there today. A lot of the popular books, much of it is garbage. Use discernment. Look it up. Evaluate. Ahaz was a syncretist, and many in our world today are falling into that same kind of trap. So then we need to move on again back to Isaiah 7, verses 3 and 4. It says, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah," after he's given us something of the context of what's going on, he says, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub." And this, I think, is taking place before the actual attack took place that was referenced earlier, so we know that it was a real legitimate threat, even though we know that we're also told that it didn't fully take over, but the threat was there and it was real. He says, "And take with you Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking firebrands.'" Maybe we could relate to a used cigarette butt. It's gone. There's nothing left. It's just worn out. That's kind of the picture. "For the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah." And then he continues, verses 5 to 7, "Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, 'Let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabal.' Thus says the Lord God, 'It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass.'" So Isaiah is given instruction to go to Ahaz and tell him, "You don't have to be afraid, because the Lord has this under control." And then he goes into a little bit more detail, verses 8 and 9. "For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken so that it will not be a people." So he's saying, you don't have to worry about it. I've got this in the bag. I've got this all figured out. You don't have to fret this. And then he says, "The head of Ephraim is Samaria. The head of Samaria is Remaliah's son." You notice how he doesn't tend to want to use his actual name, but references his son, probably in a sense demeaning him or recognizing him as not really legitimate. "If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established." So he's kind of laying it out here. And so he's, I didn't push that button soon enough. "If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established." So he's indicating he's facing a real and present consolation. There's some hope if you simply recognize it. So the Lord provided encouragement not to fear. And so he gave them some reason. So Isaiah was told to bring along his son Shear-Jashub, and Shear-Jashub's name means "a remnant shall return," perhaps a hint of a future hope for Ahaz, that even though things may go bad, God isn't going to totally abandon you. Even if you do make really dumb decisions, which he was inclined to do. So Ahaz was encouraged that the enemy would not destroy Judah completely, though there would be some impact. And this location was a vulnerable water source that Ahaz may have been examining in anticipation of the attack that was quite imminent. And it's actually the same location that Sennacherib's field commander came to hurl insults at Hezekiah, as noted in Isaiah 36:2. So this same spot comes up later in the book of Isaiah, which ultimately is the fulfillment of Isaiah's prediction of an Assyrian attack that also took place just outside the city wall there. So he was instructed not to fear, but to be quiet and to simply trust the Lord. And all of this was to indicate that the Lord was in control. He was directing things. He indicated what was going to happen and when things were going to happen, and he didn't have to be afraid. And he was noting that the threat was fading. It was just mere smoke. It was not as serious ultimately as what they were thinking, if he would just trust the Lord. And so he repeats the concerns that are there, the anger of Rezin and Pekah, the plotting of evil, the causing trouble, the breaking of the wall and replacing with a puppet king. Tabeel probably was a prominent family that is referenced there. But he's telling him this threat is not going to come to pass. It will ultimately fail. And the reference to the head of Syria and the head of Ephraim likely was indicating their limited sovereignty under the ultimate sovereign, who was God, who was directing things, if they would simply trust in him, which they did not seem too inclined to do. But this prophetic word was indicating God's knowledge of the future and his control of it. So he's telling them that you have some time because this nation, the nation of Israel, is going to cease to be a nation, cease to be a people. But what we recognize is that the northern kingdom suffered defeat in 722 BC, which was only 13 years later from this event. Well, that's a lot less than 65, but what else happened in between there? Well, in 671 BC, about 62 years later, after this prophecy was given, King Esarhaddon of Assyria began to settle foreign people from other places in the former northern kingdom, which was going to be diluting and polluting them, and they would never be the same. They would never come back from that, other than ultimately down the line the Lord would pull from those, as we recognize in Ezekiel 37, when there will be a revival of some, but that'll be in spite of all of that. So this was given to Ahaz to give him an opportunity to trust the Lord, to say, the Lord has all this under control. If you just trust him, it'll be okay. Well, what have we seen of the record of Ahaz? It has not been good. And so we shouldn't be surprised what we see coming up here, because the Lord had provided indication of the threat's failure. He said, it's not going to ultimately take place. That is, Israel, the northern kingdom, and Syria are not ultimately going to take you down, Judah and Ahaz, because they're going to be under another threat, and that was going to be Assyria. All of that is some background to come to this next place here, the rejection of a proper sign. Verses 10 through 13 says, moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. It sounds so pious, doesn't it? I wouldn't think of testing the Lord. Then he said, hear now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Now notice, here he says, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. And then down here he says, and what will you weary my God? What is he indicating? I'm not so sure we're worshiping the same God, is what Isaiah seems to be saying, because his response seemed to indicate that. So divine confirmation was available, but it was rejected. He said, just ask a sign, and it will show you that God will do exactly as he says, and you don't have to fear, and you don't have to go to Assyria to get help. What was the problem? He'd already made up his mind. This was to be a sign for encouragement to trust God. He was pushing Ahaz to make a proper decision. And so God was telling him through Isaiah to ask for a sign, and no matter how big or small or how difficult, he said, I'll provide you a sign. Now, we recognize that signs were immediate physical confirmations that what a prophet had predicted further in the future would indeed happen. It was something to say, this is certain, and I will show you this. They either confirmed that God had caused something to happen, or they confirmed that he would cause something to happen, as is the case here. Either indicating that it already had, that this was God's work, or that it was going to happen. In this case, Ahaz was given the freedom to request any type of sign. He was commanded to ask for a sign so that it could encourage him. It reminds us of Gideon, when Gideon asked for a sign and he was given one to bolster his faith. The response was a pious platitude from a mind made up. Ahaz simply refused to ask for a sign, even when commanded by God to do so, because he didn't want to confirm what he had already decided against. He had decided that he was not going to trust God, but that he had already made other arrangements. And so he didn't want confirmation that God would protect Judah, because he had already decided that he had gotten all the help he needed. Either he had made the decision or had already contacted, time frame not sure of. So he tried to justify his disobedience and his lack of faith by saying that, I wouldn't want to test Yahweh. But in the very process, that's exactly what he was doing. He was testing Yahweh. He was testing Yahweh's patience because he was not following what God asked him to do in a very specific admonition at this point. So Ahaz was wanting to appear pious and as having great faith in God so that he didn't need to have any confirmation because he'd already made up his mind. So he was making trouble for himself. Or it may be that Ahaz may have convinced himself that this alliance that he was making with Assyria was the means that God was going to use to deliver Judah. We can convince ourselves of a lot of different things. So this was actually a testing of God of another variety. And that's what he was essentially doing. So Yahweh had made a covenant promise that David's dynasty would continue forever. And he was dealing with Ahaz, who was king of Judah. So this would have been in the lineage of David. But Ahaz was concerned that maybe this threat that was given by Israel and Syria of being replaced by a puppet king might take place. And then that would throw off God's fulfillment to David, wouldn't it? And so Ahaz said, well, he's not wanting to test God, so he's refusing this sign. But he was ultimately testing God in the process. And then we note that the prophet had called Yahweh Ahaz's God, but now that the king had rebelled against him, Isaiah referred to the Lord as my God, not Ahaz's God. And that change may suggest something ominous, suggesting that God would abandon this king so that he's not with him anymore. And if Ahaz's decision resulted in God's withdrawing support from the Davidic kings, then that would indicate that the prophecy of Emmanuel may imply that God would raise up his own king from David's house who would be faithful to him when Ahaz was not. And that could explain why we have such a major messianic prediction given at this time. And that seems to be likely the case. So Ahaz is very tenuous in his continued service and questioning whether the Davidic dynasty will continue. And so there was this sign given of an assurance that the Davidic king would ultimately be there in the future, and that this one would indicate God's presence with them. So therefore, we come to the passage that we're so familiar with, Isaiah 7, 14 to 16, which says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. You won't ask for one, so the Lord himself will give you a sign." And that's plural, indicating it's the you is plural, indicating that not only Ahaz, but the nation of Judah. And then it says, "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good." And that may be indicating where it says the curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse, that it's beyond the age of just drinking milk, but eating other things. Some suggest the curds and honey suggests a poorer environment, partially due to the influence of some of the invading nations, but that's not as major of a concern at the moment. And then it says, verse 16, "For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread," that's the aggressing people, "will be forsaken by both her kings." So the people to the north of you, they're going to not be a factor in the time frame of this child knowing to refuse evil and choosing good. So then the question, well, who is this talking about? So we need to think about some details there. Divine confirmation of another sort was provided. Ahaz didn't ask for a sign of confirmation, so God gave his own sign. And he's thinking about something that has an immediate application as well as a future fulfillment. So this sign had a different purpose and focus. Israel's sovereign Lord himself would give Ahaz a sign, and that's what he's giving here. And it's an indication of a young woman who will bear a son and name him Emmanuel, and we know that means God with us. And there are several other passages that use a similar phraseology of a woman bearing a son. It's used of Hagar, of Sarah, and of Samson's mother. And in all those cases, the angel of the Lord was communicating as well in that situation. And then there's the definite article that's used with the virgin, indicating a specific one that is in view. And so this sign should have encouraged Ahaz to trust God's promise of deliverance and not rely on Assyria. He's saying, I have things planned and worked out, so you don't have to sweat what is really a problem to you right now. Then the meaning of the word virgin here has been controversial. The Hebrew word for virgin is alma, which means a young woman of marriageable age. It's a word that we'll have to look at next time when we go through chapter 8 to see what seems to be the most likely application for the immediate context of Isaiah's son, Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz. And if I had that name, I think I would prefer to go by Emmanuel also, because it's a lot easier to spell, among other things. So we'll need to give some thought to that when we look at the passage that's coming up, because it has some significance for that immediate context. In Hebrew society, an unmarried woman of marriageable age would be a virgin. The word itself doesn't exclusively indicate a virgin. There's another Hebrew word that does, and so it's assumed that it may be that this word is used, alma, to allow for an immediate application as well as a future fulfillment through Mary in the birth of Christ, and Matthew makes it very clear that that is the precise application. But another observation here is that the Greek translation, the Septuagint of the Hebrew here, uses the word parthenos, which very clearly means virgin, in addition to a young woman. So I think that's a way to give consideration to that word that's used there. And then the naming of the child was significant. The naming of a child by its mother was not uncommon in Israel. There are many biblical examples that we see there. In the case of Jesus, it was appropriate for Joseph to name him rather than Mary because of his royal status as the Messiah and as well as the Son of God, in addition to being Mary's son. So the child's mother evidently named her baby Emmanuel, or God with us, indicating something about God's continuing presence, and that because what we see here is the fear on the part of Ahaz, thinking that he can't really trust God, and therefore he has to go to Assyria to get help, and he's resisting trusting God. But God is wanting to tell him, I am with you anyway, because of my covenant relationship with David and with Abraham. And so that's what's emphasized in this passage. And then whoever this child was, and we're going to at least provide some argument that it may have been Isaiah's son, Ahaz must have learned of this birth because it was intended to be a sign to him. And so that seems to be a part of the equation. And then, as we've noted, this sign had a near and a far fulfillment and application. And so that is the thing that's communicated. If you didn't know anything beyond Isaiah chapter 7, you might not necessarily assume that this had an ultimate later fulfillment, though the emphasis seems to be there based on Isaiah's general focus. But Matthew, in his use of it, under the Holy Spirit's inspiration, makes it quite clear that that is the case. So that the Davidic lineage would continue, and the covenant of Abraham and with David would be fulfilled. So that's the major issue. So then, the threat of the perceived allies, as we continue, verses 17 through 19. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house. Days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. So This is saying the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house days that have not come. So this is a concern, and it's talking about the distress that is beyond what was experienced during the Civil War when Israel split with Jeroboam off from Judah and Rehoboam. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the furthest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. They will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks and on all the thorns and all the pastures. So what is he indicating here? Well, a far more serious threat is on the horizon. And what we see is the former Savior, that is the one that Ahaz was thinking was going to save him from Israel and Syria, is now going to be the aggressor. That's what the prediction is that he's given, giving here. And so this is talking about days are coming that will be worse than the devastating civil war of the nation when it was divided. And Assyria is not just this powerful and brutal enemy that we know that it had been and would continue to be, but it was also the instrument that God was using to bring discipline to Judah. And that helps us to realize that God himself would summon the aggressor. God is calling on Assyria, and the imagery that's used here is whistling or summoning in a very simple way, suggesting God's incredible sovereign control. And there's actually two armies that are going to be problematic. One is Egypt to the south, and then Assyria to the north. And these enemies would probably swarm around Judah. Now, they wouldn't ultimately destroy Judah, but they would give them some really serious trouble over the process of time. And that is noted later on in the book of Isaiah when it gets to another historical section just before chapter 40. So then the last part here, looking at verses 20 through 25. In the same day, the Lord will shave with a hired razor, that means he's summoning someone, with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and will also remove the beard. So he's using an imagery of shaving, which we'll have to think, well, why is he using that? And it shall be in that day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. And it shall be, and so it shall be from the abundance of milk, or the lack thereof, or the limited amount they give, that he will eat curds, for curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. It's again suggesting that maybe whatever is of things that are left. And then it shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be for briars and thorns. With arrows and bows, men will come there because all the land will become briars and thorns. And to any hill which could be dug with the hoe, you shall not go there for fear of briars and thorns, but it will become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to roam. You notice briars and thorns are mentioned several times in that passage. So what is this indicating? The future threat will affect morale and economics. The reference to the shaving, the forced removal of hair, was a sign of humiliation and domination. We have record of that in the scriptures and other accounts various times. That was part of the equation of the subjection of a people. And so that would be part of the effect of Assyria's plundering the land when they would come in and make raids and just give basic trouble. And so the picture here is, well, Judah is enlisting Assyria's help. What's wrong with the Lord enlisting Assyria's help to bring his purposes to pass? Under the restraint of subjugation, the provisions would be more limited. The flocks and the food would be much more limited, and there would be a general time of scarcity. The valuable farmland would be reduced to wilderness. And that's basically the picture that's emphasized. They would be forced to hunt for food. What was formerly productive land would be reduced for only use for grazing for just a few animals. And so it's just emphasizing again the troubled times that are coming because of a failure to trust God. That's the basic emphasis. So what do we learn from this? Well, trusting the Lord is our foremost obligation and expectation. We are not to trust in men, in political regimes, and in every other thing imaginable that we tend to put our trust in. That's what Ahaz's problem was. He was trusting in other things. Instead of trusting the Lord, we can be inclined to do the same thing. We need to resist that inclination and trust in the Lord over anything else. And you don't have to think long and hard to think about what other kinds of things we may be trusting in. Then the discipline of the Lord will come on his own people if they disobey. I mean, these were the Lord's people. This was Judah. And he was going to allow this testing of them, this troubling of them. They were not immune. They thought they were immune, but they were not to God's discipline. But the discipline can be avoided by a proper response to the Lord. And then a sign of confirmation may be an appropriate means of bolstering faith. When God wants to give us a sign, we should take heed to the sign that he gives. And the sign that is given there had implications for the immediate present, most likely, as well as ultimately for the future, anticipating the Messiah in Christ. And then often the things that we trust, other than trusting him, are the things that undermine our lives. That was the case with Ahaz and Assyria. Ahaz was trusting Assyria to solve his problems. Assyria was going to be used as a thorn in the nation's side for several years. And that was going to be the case. So we need to think about, what are we entrusting our lives to? Are we trusting in things, resources, the stuff that we have, in people, or are we trusting in the Lord? What would you do if you had been in Ahaz's situation? Would you have looked for someone like Assyria to help bail you out of a difficult situation? What are some of the things that we do resort to instead of trusting the Lord, as we're encouraged to do? Or do we need a sign that says, I'm stupid because I'm not trusting the Lord? Hopefully we don't need that kind of sign, but we'll take to heart the signs that the Lord does give us.